Okay, key thinkers in the contemporary study of religion too. Well, last week, what I tried to do a little bit, it's a pattern I'm going to try and repeat. I tried to talk about the classical approaches, quote unquote, all those wonderful names that you find in the Daniel Powell's Seven Theories of Religion, which are both, you know, exciting and stimulating to read, but also seen as methodologically completely passé. You know, so all you do is criticize them. I tried to look at them, look at how various modern factors have changed the way that we look at them, have resulted in this intense critique, but also then tried to look at the questions they were addressing, what are modern options we can take for addressing them anew? How can we alter and improve them? How can we appropriate the good and intelligently solve the problems that they raised? So we're going to try and follow a similar model here. Again, kind of referring, engaging in a conversation between a number of different modern thinkers along the way. And looking at the list, the order in which I put the topics for this lecture series, mysticism, if almost effectively, comes first. Last week we talked about anthropology, Fraser, and the tendency to talk in terms of grand narratives in which people discover themselves through the study of the exotic other. And how that's so much criticized in Fraser, but how in some ways it becomes effectively the standard methodology of anthropology in certain respects, that you include yourself in the description of the other, and that actually narrative is quite a useful category. Well, this week we're looking at mysticism and the category of the sacred, which in some ways perhaps ought to be the last category. You know, I think it's become almost passé. I think people have become very cautious about studying mysticism. And at the same time, I think it ought to come first, because it's often where people have started, at the concept of a religious feeling, of an intrinsic inner state. And in any genetic account, any account that talks about how religion arises, that explains religion in terms of its sources, you will often get that feeling. As we'll see, there are divisions. It might be a pure experience of something, or it might be a feeling about that experience. But in both cases, those will be seen as quite early stages in the genesis of religion. You know, when you see in Eliade and people like that, afterwards it turns into concept. After that, it turns into text. After that, it turns into creed, and then it turns into institution, and etc., etc. So it's quite an important thing from a genetic account. And I think it's also important, I've kind of talked about this a little bit in the first quote that you've got. I think it's also important because for a lot of people, actually, the mystical was the goal, was the raison d'etre of the study of religion. They wanted to know about the ideas. And they, you know, even in Fraser, you get this sense of cultural pluralism. We want to understand other cultures. But deep down underneath, there was often this desire to find out what was at the heart of religion. What was that mystical encounter that it's really all about? Why did they want to find out about it? The reductionists, of course, wanted to, because they thought if they could strike at the core, then they could, you know, get rid of the dark growth that arises from it. But I think in many cases, you look at a lot of writers, they're talking about the core because they're fascinated with it, because they think there's treasure there, you know. And in some sense, that's what they want. People have talked about that. Russell McCutcheon talks about this. Always one to look at the history of religion and what it's involved, talks about the idea that actually the study of religion has sometimes been a kind of spiritual practice itself, and that people are trying to almost replicate the things that they're talking about. Not always. Of course, that's always in a dialectic with critique, and yet there's always a little questing within these ideas. And I've just put, you know, in Eliade, a critical reader. He's a good thinker to do at the moment, because there is actually writing on him, not true of everybody. I don't know that there's the same attention to Rudolf Otto. But in Eliade, a critical reader, William Pardon writes, "The experience of the sacred is the linchpin concept that once defined, unified, and inspired the history of religion's field, that to some extent gave it a reason for existing." You know, this crucial key thing, which is supposed to be the key to everything else. And of course, you know, secretly, that perennial philosophy that reemerges in John Hick, this idea that actually it's not just a thing people experience, you know, actually, it's a window onto the real. It's touching the sacred. And people are hoping that from that touch, they can see the genesis of everything, but also perhaps get closer themselves. And I think that ideal is there. I think it's very interesting. And indeed, I think you do see this in Rudolf Otto and in other people who seek not only to describe this experience, but also to evoke it. And we'll come back to this, but Otto's a really, I think those first two chapters, even just the prologues of The Idea of the Holy, are fascinating. Where amongst other things, he says, a quote that I'll give you later, he says things like, this is an irreducible and crucial experience, and if you've never had it, then don't read any further. You know, who writes that at the beginning of a book? You know, and of course, most people now, I think, I ask my students, and they usually say, no, I haven't had that experience. And I think probably most people then, in many ways. And remember, he's talking to post-war German youth. He's talking post-war Germany, which is feeling very spiritually bereft at this point, post-First World War. You know, have you had that experience? No, I haven't. Close the book and put it down. Of course, he doesn't mean that. What he means to do is to pique your curiosity. Like Fraser, he's a very literary writer. And he immediately then goes on to describe it in terms that are meant to evoke the feeling in you. So you really see reflected in the literature not only the idea that you're going to describe it and analyze it, but also you're going to bring it out in the reader. And again, as I sort of tried to argue with Fraser, while this has been seen as rather, you know, methodologically naive, it's too literary, it's, you know, that's not your job as a student of religions. I think there are very good methodological reasons behind this. How are you going to talk about a subjective inner experience unless you can get the other person to see what it is that you're talking about? But of course, it's not in the external world. You can't point to it. So how are you going to get them to see that? I think, again, the literary may turn out to be quite useful here. So what we have more broadly in the classical idea of mysticism, which I put is also an ideal in many ways for the subject, are various things. It's seen as a universal, of course. It's the place where all the religions can meet. It's something that's supposed to be there in all religious experience. Of course, that's going to be challenged. It's seen as an a priori theological foundation. And especially when you're reading Otto, you know, it's important to keep in mind how much he's influenced by Kantian, and in fact even more Fries, I don't know how you pronounce his name actually, Fries, I don't know, but Friesian philosophy, who, very similar to Kant, subtle philosophical differences, but both felt basically that there is the world of your perception, and that's always a filter. Beyond it is the real world. And they're both concerned with how you can possibly get beyond the filter of your perception, the veil of your ideas. Kant, of course, says you can't get to the thing in itself. And Otto's developing a slightly alternative variation of this, where he says, not with your five senses, but as it were, with your sixth sense, with your religious sense, this special experience of the numinous, you can actually get beyond the filter and get to a pure, real, certain transcendental foundation. He's a very philosophical writer in that way. And in that, when he's trying to talk about an a priori truth, it's part of the enduring appeal of not only the idea of the holy, Otto's book, but also of the idea of the mystical experience in general. That this is something that not only grounds religion, but also offers a much stronger foundation for a whole range of things. In fact, perhaps the whole of life. Perhaps this is the only truth that we can find. Later, I think it's also become popular, people like Hick, because it's outside the sphere of conflict. Because it's, if you accept the idea that it's non-conceptual, and all the concepts come afterwards and are imposed upon it, then of course that makes a really nice pluralistic model. All the religions see the same big, wordless, conceptless object, and then they put some concepts on afterwards. And not only is that kind of an appealing idea in some ways, but it means that the religions don't have to argue about anything anymore ever, because all their doctrinal differences are really all set in the sphere of the mind, as it were, of the cultural, personal, perceptual matrix. So it's also kind of handy in that way. It's seen, you know, for all the people who are looking for a definition of religion, it gave a handy essence. It, you know, what is religion? Religion is this. You know, William James, excuse me, reflects that in this idea, you know, religion has many facets, but it's always about, ultimately, at the beginning, about a key religious experience. So for a lot of people, it also offered that definition that's so hard to find. It's a genetic account. You know, and we've talked about, you know, Darwin and the idea of origins is very important. Everyone wants to know where things come from. That's how you explain things now. And it gives you, you know, a source, apparently, in this respect. And it kind of gives religion its own special subject that no other subject can study. And again, you see that quite strongly in Otto. This is irreducible. No, this isn't like anything else. This is a uniquely, specifically religious experience. And that's very relevant today when, in religious studies, a lot of people are thinking through whether or not religious studies has its own special method and subject. Could we just be chopped up and divided into anthropology, philosophy, theology, sociology, etc.? You know, and here seem to be a very unique and special disciplinary topic for religious studies. I think it's also, you know, it's also interesting to see how it's kind of romantic and appealing. It suggests it's very romantic in the technical sense. It talks about the inner life and addresses the inner world of the individual. But it's also romantic in the sense it seems to be about exciting, otherworldly, exotic experiences, something to aspire to. It suggests charismatic individuals throughout the course of history. It's like William James's version of events, where a few individuals have extraordinary experiences and the rest of us follow them. Again, it's kind of an exciting narrative of history. These great leaders or saints or whatever, these figures who guide us and to whom we can barely aspire to. For a lot of people, these kinds of stories of history are quite appealing. And also, I think it's interesting, it's important to note with Otto especially, this sort of beginning matrix of the mysticism field, that it's a connection between his very Lutheran German outlook, his sense that the religion is about a personal, intimate engagement with the divine, very private, between that and actually probably the culture that the Germans are just about most interested in studying at that time, the Indians. And it seemed to fit very well with the kind of Indian outlook of, you know, meditative, inward-looking, quote-unquote, mysticism. And that connection is made very strongly. It's always interesting to read Rudolf Otto in relation to people like Hermann Hesse and Thomas Mann and, you know, just get a sense of where that whole period's spiritual outlook was. So it becomes an ideal. Right up, for a long time, I think, right up until the structuralists and the phenomenologists and the psychologists start to take over, when they start to refer us back again to the phenomena, to the veil, and not the thing in itself beyond it. It remains an ideal for quite a long time. And I think even when I first started in academia in sort of 1994-5, it was still a great fascination with mysticism. I think it was an even more popular subject, and people still thought, you know, John Hick was running around giving lectures, and people thought, yeah, maybe there is a priori transcendent object. It also engaged very much with the idea that maybe there's a truth claim under there. And of course, again, that truth claim, you're not supposed to make truth claims in religious studies anymore. But it was very exciting for a lot of people to think that maybe we had found the source of the perennial philosophy, quote unquote. But it couldn't, as it stood, it wasn't going to survive postmodern skepticism about methods or motives. I'll come back to those later. It wasn't going to survive those sorts of problems. I put a quote in here from Rudolf Otto that just gives you a sense of his Kantian background. And I'll read that out before I go on to the critiques. It's the second quote. Otto says, "It is worthwhile, as we have said, to find a word to stand for this element." He's talking about the pre-rational element. in isolation. He wants to find a word and, you know, kind of reify it into a distinct and definite experience. A word to stand for this element in isolation, this extra in the meaning of holy, above and beyond the meaning of goodness. By means of a special term, we shall the better be able, first, to keep the meaning clearly apart and distinct. And I shall speak then of a unique numinous category of value, and of a definitely numinous state of mind, which is always found wherever the category is applied. This mental state is perfectly sui generis, and irreducible to any other. And therefore, like every absolutely primary and elementary datum, while it admits of being discussed, it cannot be strictly defined. It's a really packed little quote. He wants to give it a word, partly so that he can isolate it. That's been criticized by other people who said, you can't isolate that experience. It's part of the wider matrix of experience. But he wants to give it its own little category, the numinous. He wants to give it a very sort of Latin, categorizing kind of a name. It sounds like a more definite thing. It's very popular at that time in the wake of biology to categorize things and then give them Latin generic names. And he wants to speak of a definitely numinous state of mind. This is partly what we feel uncomfortable about doing now, is talking about anybody's state of mind, because they're so hard to access, which is always found wherever the category is applied. Well, that, you know, of course, is in question. You know, that you could even hope to impose such an elusive thing onto a wide religious range. This mental state, perfectly sui generis, it's unique, it's not connected to anything else. You know, that's very much comes into question. It's irreducible to any other. That's directly going to be opposed, and is opposed by all of the reductionists who say, no, what that really is anxiety or desire for social affirmation or whatever. And he makes this claim, it's an absolutely primary and elementary datum, very much the language of Kantian philosophy. From where he stands, he's trying to assert that this is something that has not been filtered hermeneutically. It cannot be strictly defined, but it can be discussed. That's interesting. That's very different from what we get today. You know, every book, if you read every study of religions guide that's come out in the last, 5-10 years, they start with a definition. And in fact, I felt terribly guilty. I started teaching a study of religion course, and I started talking about the definition of religion, and they all looked crestfallen and thought, well, we know more or less what it is. Can't we just carry on and talk about it? And you say, no, methodologically, that's naive. We don't do that anymore. But of course, Otto just says, we can't define it, but we can discuss it, which is interesting. I'm also teaching a course called The Philosophy of Love, and you quickly realize you can't define it very well. You know, you can't describe certain feelings. In fact, some of the most key feelings of value that humans have are quite hard to describe, to define, but we certainly discuss them a great deal. You know, and a large, probably the majority of the world's literature and art is about things that aren't easily defined in that way. So it's an interesting quote, which is both terribly naive and also in some ways quite prescient, and genuinely both, I think. So what's the critique? Well, we know basically, this is seen to be far too individualistic. The idea that you're going to look at specific individuals and not at the wider scale is seen as a bit passé in many cases, I think. Some of these critiques, I think, are about trends that have arisen. You think in terms of the social now. You talk about the individual in terms of his social context, his inscription with social values, his location within the social matrix. And so it's very unfashionable, I think, in a way, to say, we're not going to worry about the social, we're going to talk about people and their unique individual experience. And there's a valid, important methodological point in there. The idea that there's a theological truth claim in there, that there's a real reference, of course, is completely, and in some ways, rightly. I mean, it's a big issue about how you mediate people's truth claims within the study of religion. You need, if you've got religious people, you can't deny that they're there. And I think you should have religious people. The idea of religion faculties with nothing but interested atheists seems, you know, odd and methodologically unsound as well. I always, the happiest faculty I was ever in had a nice sprinkling of pretty much everything. But it's true that you have to be careful how to mediate truth claims in a pluralistic context. It wasn't such a problem before because everyone agreed. And so now that's problematic. And I think very much also there's the idea that the Kantian Friesian paradigm, the idea that you might try and get to the thing in itself, has been philosophically rejected. Now the paradigm is not Kant and Fries. Now the paradigm is Husserl and Heidegger. It's all phenomenology and hermeneutics. And that is going to look at things in a very different way. It sounds very prescriptive, Otto and perhaps Eliade as well. Incidentally, there's a lot of debate over in the study of Eliade over whether you have to take him as asserting that there's a transcendent sacred object that corresponds to your feeling, or whether you can say, no, he's not making any claim about what it's a feeling about. He's just saying that you have the feeling. Some will take him as a sort of phenomenologist, and some will take him as a truth claimant. Well, the idea that people like Otto are prescribing how you should look at religion and indeed what religion should be is very problematic. Same kind of problems actually that are true of people like Paul Tillich, whose definition I love. You know, religion is ultimate concern. There's that wonderful quote, you know, religion is not something that's very important, nor is it very, very, very important. It's supposed to be the most important thing that there could possibly be for the religious person. That's what ultimate concern means. I think it's a really interesting quote. It's a really interesting observation. But of course, it's also, you know, its biggest methodological problem is that it's very prescriptive. And a lot of people who will self-designate as religious will say, well, wait a second, that's not exactly how I think about it. It's something that I do. It's part of my life, but it's not some central matrix. It's not the center of the world, the center of gravity, the most important thing in the world. You know, which in itself is an interesting claim. But anyway, so that's problematic. It's also, I think, the case, especially with Rudolf Otto, that it's a very genetic account in a naive sense. He says, here's the experience, and he gives quite a specific ladder of how that develops. Here's the experience. Then you get the concept, then you get maybe the experience, then the feeling, and then a broad concept in pictures and ideograms, which you then turn into coherent doctrines, which then turn into et cetera, et cetera. And I think it's true maybe that is no longer accepted, that, you know, religion doesn't necessarily start with somebody going, oh my God, I can see it, and then trying to explain it. And everyone else goes, oh, blimey, let's talk about that. You know, in many cases, people will come in at various different points along the way in that progression. A child comes in, learns about the doctrines, gets a sense of the concepts, the ideograms that he'd say, starts to get the feeling, and maybe one day has the experience. It can go backwards, for instance. It could go around in circles. It could move in different ways within that schema. So that's been changed. I think actually that's something that Geertz tries to show is how circular all the different moments of religion can be. They kind of feed into each other. And generally, I think it's important to see that the motivations are seen as suspect. The idea of the perennial philosophy, that wonderful, you know, Temenos group of Jung and Eliade and people like this who used to get together and discuss religion and really felt that it was the perennial philosophy. It was very romantic and exciting, you know, but you can't do that within a faculty now. I think in some ways it's a mistake that John Hick made, and people have said this to him, you know, you're not really giving an account of the world's religions, you're giving your own theology, which they may disagree about. You know, you're not really assimilating them to a single model, you're actually giving your own interpretation of what they're doing. And I think, and he admits that, he knows that he's ultimately a theologian. And of course, you know, that you can also say that in some ways there's an exoticism of the mystical in Otto and in Eliade, this idea that it's unique, it's special, it's totally different from the everyday. It's something of a qualitatively different character, like another world. That's been criticized from the perspective, as we'll see, that it's overly, it elevates it, it isolates it, it exoticizes, romanticizes, and even, quote-unquote, orientalizes it. You get that kind of point made by Said and Richard King. I think the biggest problem, save the biggest problem to the end, is that it's about the subjective, it's about the internal, it's about internal states of mind. It's about the bit that you can't get at, you can't describe it, you can't verify it. All you get is the descriptions. You never have access to the actual thing itself. And personally, I think it's a huge issue. I think there's been a shift to the idea that you can't talk about what's internal. You have to talk about what's external, because methodologically, the internal is not accessible to you. And therefore, to do a good, solid job, we have to sort of leave that out or reduce everything to the external, which I think is problematic. If you'll forgive me, can I take questions at the end? Because I just want to make sure I get through the whole paper. So this idea of inaccessibility to scientific study has become an issue. The shift to the observable. And I think there's also a sense that ultimately now, it's interesting to look at the recent study of religion's guides. There's the Guide to the Study of Religion by Cassell. There's the Routledge Guide to the Study of Religion. There's the Critical Terms in Religious Studies. There's the Continuum one. They all have a chapter on experience. And actually, most of them spend most of their time rejecting that old classical and isolated and special sphere model. And they spend a lot of their time trying to turn it back towards the everyday world. Partly because they want to expand it to cover the idea of the mystical experience, the religious experience. They want to expand it to cover a wider range of religious forms than just, in a way, the Indian and maybe the Lutheran paradigm. And they also want to, in a very valid way, they want to do the opposite of what William James does. Well, William James says it's all about those individuals of spiritual genius. You know, for him, the category of religion, in a sense, ends up being only, the Prophet Muhammad, Jesus, Zoroaster, Moses, and a couple of other people. That idea that we no longer must talk about just the upper-class literate males as the whole sphere of a religion, but encompass a wider ethnic, a wider social, a wider cultural range, bring in the margins and bring them into our definition, bring in the masses, indeed, to our definition of religion. That's become important. For a lot of people, they want to say, no, if you want to look at the period in which the Upanishads are written, a few people had the chance to sit around meditating, but actually most people were probably doing something else because they had to take care of their kids and till the fields. And so what did religion actually mean for them? Now, it's a very valid and important point. If you're going to talk about religion, let's talk about the whole thing. What about prayer? What about ethics? What about ritual? What about everyday behavior, etc., etc.? So I think, now tell me if I'm wrong, I'd like to hear more about what does happen out there. But I feel like after Eliade, it's interesting to note how there aren't many other individuals who seem to talk in a really interesting way about mystical experience or religious experience. It often veers into the realm of anthropology, which is fine, but or into philosophy, you'll get it talked about, but they don't have the same strictures sort of imposed upon them. And also you'll see in many cases the category of quote-unquote mysticism will get expanded to include not just a pure mystical encounter that's a unifying encounter, but it will also have to involve vision encounters, personal encounters of exchange and interaction with the divine in a personal form, participatory encounters with the divine where you don't lose your individuality, but you come into some relationship, perhaps a dynamic relationship, emotional encounters, kenotic encounters. Sufism's really interesting because in some ways, everyone learns about Al-Halaj who cries, I am the truth, and is burnt for being a monist. And the idea that Sufism is in some sense a monistic form in some of the thinkers anyway. But of course, a lot of them, when they talk about I become you, only you are true, I'm within you, often if you look at the language they're talking about, emptying out the self and being filled with the divine. It's not that the self turns out to be the divine or literally merges with the divine. It's more that you are a cup, and the more that you empty out the ego, the more the divine can come in and fill your individuality. So you get all these different modes of union, which I think weren't always recognized and are kind of crying out to be affirmed. So what are some of the contemporary ways that people try and deal with this? Well, just briefly, in some ways, I think Otto's project of trying to identify that unique consciousness experience and analyze it has gone in a quite an extraordinary and slightly strange, interesting, potentially fruitful direction, which is to talk about how can we analyze quote-unquote pure consciousness experiences. If this is indeed sui generis, if all of this scientific language is appropriate, how are we going to look at this and see what happens? And at one end of that, you've got people like Robert Forman, whose book The Problem of Pure Consciousness came out in 1997, who gives a whole analysis of what he thinks the pure consciousness experience might be, and indeed bases it. But, I mean, significantly, methodologically, how is he going to do this? He has almost to base it on an experience of his own. That's what gives him a foundation from which to do that. And he writes in The Problem of Pure Consciousness, in describing this experience, he says, "I knew that before hearing the knock, for some indeterminable length of time prior to the knocking, I had been awake, but with no content for my consciousness. The experience was so unremarkable as it was utterly without content." He says it was so unremarkable that if someone hadn't kind of pointed it out, if the knocking hadn't alerted him, he would have just drifted back into normal consciousness and never even realized that it was there, because it was a kind of such an empty experience. And incidentally, this does happen, I think, within the context of a meditative practice. Otherwise, we might say that he'd fallen asleep with his eyes open. You know, it's interesting, you know, that this then is... That's a description. It's an interesting description. It's a fairly minimal description. He then goes on to talk about consciousness as contentless and analyzes how that could happen and what that could mean. And actually, that didn't win him that many friends. A recent book, I can't remember when it was, 2003 or something like that. What's the name? Reza Shah something or other. A book called Paths to Transcendence, which looks at Shankara, Ibn Arabi, and I think it's Meister Eckhart. Old-fashioned comparative religion between three mystical traditions and how they describe this union, this pure consciousness union experience of transcendence. The book itself is full of those old truth claims that can be problematic. Here's what I think. This is how it can be described. If you don't agree, then the whole project looks shaky. But there is an interesting final chapter where he looks at contemporary approaches to the mystical experience and critiques them. And one of the ones he critiques is Robert Forman. He says Forman thinks he's helping out us who are interested in this experience, but by defining it in such a bizarre scientific way and insisting that it has no content, in a way that doesn't seem to quite reflect Eliade's notion. He says he's not really helping. Otto. For Eliade and Otto both, there's the sense that this sacred, this irreducible and unique religious sphere is a rising up from the mundane. The one thing it has, it doesn't have necessarily content in itself, but it does. It is replete with value. And value is not, you know, propositionally, conceptually full of content, but value is a very significant thing. And that's something that you don't see in Forman. You know, he wakes up and he goes, oh, well, whatever, and he moves on. But it hasn't been an encounter with something noumenal in the sense of having a higher level. Something, as Eliade puts it, something that is real, that is really real. It is of the real in a way that the everyday that you've come out of isn't, actually. So Forman's ideas kind of passes by a little bit. To some extent, that has been taken up, I think, by neurological approaches. You know, things like the not Alistair Harley, but the centre here in Oxford that looks into neurological approaches to religious experience, that looks into scientific biological approaches to what happens in the brain. That's become very popular, to try and see, for instance, what a contentless experience would look like. People have done studies of Tibetan monks meditating and noticed that the bits of your brain that normally register physical boundaries stop working, and that normally register time stop working, suggesting that, yes, you know, they're having an experience that doesn't have temporal or spatial content to it. You know, what would that mean? So there's a whole area there that people look into that's potentially fruitful, although, again, methodologically just as weak as anything else in a lot of ways, but for different reasons. I'm going to pass on from that. One of the main things that I think has happened is that people have decided to demythologize mysticism. They've said, okay, here's the mystical. But we don't want it to be this unique, a priori, exotic, other experience for various reasons. How can we shift away from that? Particularly Timothy Fitzgerald in the Cassell Guide to the Study of Religion, and Robert Scharf in the Critical Terms in Religious Studies books, you know, almost, you know, extraordinarily say almost exactly the same thing. They critique the old approach in order to affirm the sacred cosmos. It's not a unique part. It's the whole cosmos which has been raised up into the sacred. And the whole cosmos includes every bit of your activity, every bit of your life. It's almost as if they're trying to democratize the sacred, the mystical, the religious experience. You know, someone says, oh, I had a mystical experience yesterday. And the other person goes, how dare you impose your superior mystical experience on me? I have one all the time. You can see I'm skeptical of some parts of this. You know, but they have a lot to draw on. Peter Berger's notion of cosmos in the Sacred Canopy, Victor Turner's idea of communitas, Lawrence Sullivan, writing on Eliade in the Eliade Critical Reader, says, looking upon the remarkable number of forms that have manifested the sacred throughout the broad history of religions, one concludes that symbolic life tends to identify the universe as a whole with hierophany, and thereby opens human existence to a significant world. And of course, these are true and useful points in many key ways that I'll talk about in a second. Fitzgerald says, yes, that's right. Instead of just mystical peak or ecstatic experiences, quote, we should look at day-by-day commitment, ritual participation. And you can see he explicitly has in mind the idea that he wants mysticism to come to be able to refer to modern-day Christians as well as, you know, meditative sages far away. So he goes on to say, what must be stressed is that few members of Christian communities get a beatific vision of God, Jesus, angels, saints, or the Virgin Mary. It's a regular involvement in the network of ritual institutions rather than a claimed direct experience of God, which counts to make an experience a religious experience. It's an interesting claim. And I think I both agree and disagree. That's both true and essential that religious experience be able to encompass the widest range of experiences. At the same time, I go to Italy. I've done projects where I go to Italy and other countries, and I say to people, you know, talk to them about their religious experience, their religious life, and they'll say, yes, I feel God. I feel God all the time. I talk to God, and I feel that He's talking back to me. They're not using Otto's language. They don't say I have a priori, primary and elementary datum, but they do say I feel like I'm directly encountering God, and often in a way that is not about a conceptual experience. It's a feeling. It's an encounter. So I feel a bit cautious about that. There's an agenda behind this shift, some of which is very important. There's a desire to reflect the indigenous religions and Christianity, a lot of religions for which it's not about a revealed scripture, a specific religious site, a religious person, but religion is actually part of everyday life. And so that anthropological move towards quote-unquote indigenous religions has affected it. It focuses on observable behavior. Mark Taylor says interiority is the last refuge of Lutheran and Kierkegaardian dreams about the interior. It seeks, yeah, the democratization of religion to normal life, reflecting the masses. It wants to affirm the body and the real. It's very Foucauldian. The idea that, you know, from Nietzsche to Marx to Foucault, we're being urged to encourage the body, to affirm the body, to affirm the real, so that we no longer are alienated from ourselves by some ideal of a spiritual other. That is much more far-reaching, I think, than people always recognize. And there's a strong sense here where they're saying, no, no, don't reject the body, don't reject the real. What we're actually doing is trying to affirm the body and affirm the real and your everyday life and your cooking soup for your kids. That too is religious experience. Very positive. You know, but at the same time, a little bit of a suspicious agenda, I think, in some ways. You know, some of those people will say, well, actually, cooking soup for my kids isn't that much of a religious experience in a sacralized cosmos. What I want is the step up to the other. You know, for some people, that's the point. It doesn't really help to tell them that what they do every day is great. For some people, that idea of a hierarchical, you know, ascent is actually the core of the religious. So I think that there are difficulties in there. And ultimately, you see in Fitzgerald's essay and also Jonathan Z. Smith's essay, Religion, Religions, and Religious in the Critical Terms book, they want not only to affirm indigenous religions and everyday Christianity, in the end, they want to be able to take this back to the secular world. It's also about an agenda that wants to be able to say religion can now encompass the non-religious, the secular as well. Something I'm very sympathetic to, but I'm a bit suspicious of doing it in that way. So there's a refusal of what Eliade has posited as the essence of religion, a division between the mundane, what he calls the profane, and the sacred. And you can argue, well, surely that's what soteriology is all about, is salvation, is to be saved from something towards something else. That religion is about the idea that the everyday isn't enough, you add something on. It's true, you can argue very convincingly, and I think often rightly, against that. A lot of religions aren't about saving. There are a lot of non-soteriological religions. And so it does a good job of talking about that. And I think it's quite right to say that to look at law as something that can be a spiritual experience, that can be validly and importantly actually very mystical in some sense. Law in the sense of bending your actions and your body to a set of rules, to a ritual act, to a participatory pattern that you instantiate in your real life. That has been seen, especially in the modern world, I think. A lot of people go, oh, that's awful, that's really tedious, that isn't the essence of religion at all. And of course, that can be very, very spiritual, quote-unquote, very affective and feeling-oriented thing. But I do think that there are problems there. Maurice Bloch has criticized the idea that religious experience is a reminder of transcendence. You have them as a talisman against death. That's the only reason you want these transcendent experiences. You're scared of death. And he notes that many forms of trying to get a religious experience involve some kind of violence towards the body. He's thinking particularly of asceticism, obviously. You know, and that fits very much into that Foucauldian critique. You know, you reject the body in order to get something else. As Marx says in Feuerbach, why not just affirm the body in the first place? Well, as I've said, I have some issues with that. I think in some ways, Eliade's idea of a value scale, that there is something about religious experience, is about a heightening according to a certain scale of value, as opposed to the lower levels of the scale of value, as the idea of the sacred, the idea of the center of the world, you want to get to the center of the world, is interesting. I won't say it's right. I think they're both right in their own sphere. It fits very well with Tillich, fits in ways with Berger, fits very well with Bultmann as the idea that, you know, the religious is what engages with more important, more urgent issues in life. And Geertz makes this point because he dares to talk about when religions become stale. Geertz is very interesting because everyone else will say, oh yes, and when you go around cooking your soup, you know, that's a happy religious experience, potentially in a sacralized cosmos. But Geertz would want to say, No, it is the case that people experience a religion no longer heightening them. You will do everyday things in a sacralized cosmos, but not be happy with it. And that shows you, that's his key thesis in Islam Observed. He wants to see what happens when a religion loses its power. And that shows you that a religion has to add something of value over and above the everyday, what Fitzgerald calls, the day-to-day life. So there are ways to look at that. Maybe Hick's notion of seeing as is more useful. He says, yes, you can be in a sacralized cosmos where the everyday is sacred, but that's about taking the mundane and seeing it as sacred. The whole thing does go up a level. You haven't got this danger of leveling everything down to a kind of non-value. I think it's important to notice that there are breakthrough experiences in the religions. People talk about, again and again, a higher state. And if you deny that, you end up making mistakes. Fitzgerald ends up arguing that the revelation of Krishna to Arjuna in the Bhagavad Gita, in those middle chapters where he reveals his true Godhead, he says, oh yes, and even this is really just about asserting the duty of a Kshatriya warrior to fulfill his social rules. And you kind of think, have you read that chapter? Are you really clear about that? Scharf says that Indian meditation, he says the ultimate paradigm of this is Hindu meditation, he says, but even that is more about, quote-unquote, eliminating defilement, accumulating merit and supernatural power, and invoking apotropaic deities, and so forth. That's in there, but I think even people I know who meditate today, they're not necessarily aiming at eliminating defilement, accumulating merit and supernatural power, and invoking apotropaic deities. I think they're trying to achieve a state of mind. So there's a danger of, I think, potentially saying useful, but if you broaden them out too much, rather silly things. Sorry, guys. I've only got a few minutes just to briefly gesture towards the other ways that it can be done. Phenomenology has, of course, become terribly important. And more, as people have shifted away from the a priori pure experience towards the interpretation, you'll have religious experience in terms of the imaginal world. Entering into the world view, the religious cosmos, and kind of instantiating that, being in it. There's a nice quote from Georges Santayana that having another world to live by and stepping at least partly over into it, that is what is religious, he says. And that's kind of an interesting idea. You see that reflected in various places. Geertz's, it also helps because then you can start talking about world, social context, imaginal context. It broadens out a little bit. Geertz talks about his Sufi saints in Morocco and in Indonesia and puts them in their context and shows how they have their inner world, which is a religious world, and what it means to go into that world. Gavin Flood's book on Tantra very much engages with this in quite a critical way. The idea that he talks about the religious imaginaire, and I've put a quote in the notes, which I won't read out in detail. Perhaps the body is central to the tantric imaginaire, the body as the key to making this real, he says. Central to the tantric imaginaire, serving as the focus for the self-enactment of tradition through ritual and asceticism. Going on, the body is the central organizing topos or metaphor of the traditions, which structures idea of power, vision, and levels of awakening in our texts. The body entails a corporeal understanding that functions not only as a conceptual scheme, but as a lived experience. There's a conceptual scheme, a world, which is made real through the lived experience of the body. And in this way, he can broaden out the picture. And that's become quite popular and quite interesting. I think, again, I won't go into it in detail, but I think Geertz's definition, which I gave you on the last handout, in fact, it's up here, system of symbols, it looks at the different aspects of that process, a system of symbols, powerful and pervasive and long-lasting moods and motivations, conceptions of a general order of existence, an aura of factuality, which is uniquely realistic. You've got all these different moments in the creation of that world which you can bring together to get an interesting phenomenological account of the whole process, how the ideas are created, how they're lived, how they're made real, and what effect they have emotionally. That takes us on to a further category, religious experience as emotion. And this has become important partly because, of course, if you're shifting from, say, an Indic context or an Indian or Buddhistic context over to a devotional context, I don't want to say that, if you're shifting from a mystical context to a devotional context, which also means that the study of Hinduism, for instance, has engaged the study of bhakti more, and perhaps, you know, it no longer focuses quite so much on quote-unquote Advaita, etc., then you have to talk about emotion as, in fact, really key. I think perhaps that is true. It is key to the religious experience of the masses, in prayer, in song, in hymn, in worship, in myth and story, and in many different contexts. Actually, emotion is crucial, and that's useful. People have started to talk about that a little bit more. Not enough, I think. There's a wider movement to complement the post-Enlightenment idea that thought is reason and rationality, to complement that with the notion that there is also emotion. You know, Husserl is notorious for only including rationality as the phenomenal world. People don't always know that there was a second phenomenologist called Max Scheler at the same time, who was seen as much more exciting, although less accurate, I think, less precise. And Scheler wrote a phenomenology of the emotions, which he connected to religion. S-C-H-E-L-E-R. And he got forgotten, and Husserl's rational model was taken up. And now we've got people like Martha Nussbaum, Simon Blackburn, reminding us of the emotional. Even Geertz's Moods and Motivations being in there was quite a radical move at the time. In the Critical Terms and Religious Studies book, I realize you're going to have to go, Donald Lopez points out how the word belief actually comes from the old German Glauben, belieben, to love. I believe in, say, Christ being my savior. Is like saying, I love that Christ is my savior. I love that idea, and that is why it is mine, and I go along with it. So there are interesting moves towards a sort of re-emotionalization of belief. That also, of course, falls prey to the problem of subjectivity. I won't go any further for now. I'll just say that I think if you go back to Otto, if you go back even to Fraser, if you go back to Eliade, this idea that they try and inspire in people the feeling that they're talking about. And I put that last quote from Eliade at the very bottom, where he says we can help, there's only one way to help another to an understanding of the feeling. He must be guided and led on by consideration and discussion. We can cooperate in this process by bringing to his notice all that is familiar. We can add, this X is not exactly it, but it's similar. Can you not now realize for yourself what it is? In other words, it cannot, strictly speaking, be taught. It can only be evoked and awakened in the mind, as everything that comes of the spirit must be awakened. That of the spirit is a reminder that he's very interested in Hegel, actually. And what he's talking about is a dialectical evoking of the spiritual, of the experience itself, so that you can bring it into the public sphere and talk about it. It's kind of circling back to the idea that in some ways people felt that to talk about mysticism, you had to be willing to engage at least a little in trying to find out what the experience involved. And that seems extreme and extraordinary. What are we going to go do yoga until we experience samadhi? But at the same time, if you then read the way that Otto and other people try to evoke by very literary, artistic, evocative terms, some hint of this feeling, it's surprisingly easy to get a little bit of that into the discourse if you're willing to go out on a limb in that way. Methodologically difficult, but maybe the subjective sphere in general is something that will never be as methodologically sound as other areas of observation, and yet that doesn't mean that you stop talking about it. You then look for new techniques, which I think is an exciting potential for the study of mysticism.